Deborah Gray White has edited this wonderful new collection called Telling Stories, which I have an essay in, but also reminded me of the importance of locating ourselves in the histories that we write about, to locate our stories and our history in the work that we do. So for me, actually, 1968 began in the summer of 1967. That was my watershed. I was 10 years old and growing up in a black working class neighborhood on the west side of Detroit. One of the bloodiest rebellions of the 1960s erupted a few short miles from my house. I remember National Guard tanks rolling down my narrow street and soldiers with rifles standing outside the supermarket down the block. Less than a year later, my family was transfixed as we watched the news of King's assassination. My mother, who was not a particularly religious woman, began praying, and my father, who was characteristically very gregarious, was fuming. So as a small child, those were the personal markers for me that something fundamentally important was occurring. As a child, I also began to ask questions that since historians have attempted to answer. Why did my neighbors have to wait for the whole neighborhood to catch fire to finally get a black and white television? I was glad that they did, but this reflected a demand for the redistribution of wealth, which was a part of a 60s movement. Why did the white families on TV seem so better off than all the families I knew? They had multiple appliances that were sparkling and seemed to be doing quite well. I came to understand that the economic hierarchy was color-coded. And why did the white-owned businesses in my neighborhood, as well as some of the black-owned businesses, put up Soul Brothers signs in their windows? It was a microcosm of the social construction of race. So here we are 40 years since King's tragic assassination, and the world has changed enormously in ways that neither King, nor Ella Baker, nor Rosa Parks, or Amesie Moore could have imagined. There is a rough and brutal fight right now, I would argue, over the meaning of that history. I think sometimes as historians we forget exactly how high the stakes are. There is a systematic hijacking of the legacy of the movement. There are initiatives called the Civil Rights Initiative that in fact attempt to turn around, transform, distort, and denigrate much of what the civil rights generation fought for. Undoing affirmative action in the name of colorblindness, undoing many of the modest victories that people were able to win. Now, on that battlefield for the public imagination, there have been some interesting moments. What I have found particularly interesting, and I want to talk about three just briefly as a sort of fodder for our discussion later, I have been particularly struck by the way in which we attempt to bring closure to a historical period through the rituals of burial and dying. I'm referring here to the funerals of civil rights icons, Rosa Parks some years ago, Coretta Scott King more recently, and also the revisiting of cold civil rights cases, the actual exhumation of Emmett Till's body in 2005, for example. What do these rituals mean and what do they represent in terms of how a dominant narrative is being constructed and inscribed in the public imagination about the civil rights and black freedom movements? When Rosa Parks died, for example, there were really three services for her, Montgomery, Detroit, and a ceremony in DC. But if you recall, she was laid in state in the US Capitol Rotunda. President Bush laid a wreath at the coffin. It was as if having her body on display was a way to finally close the chapter on an era, and some commentators said as much. She was praised by conservatives and liberals alike as a great civil rights leader, one of the good kind, that is the nonviolent ones, who helped this country wrestle with the demons of racism and defeat them. Bush issued a proclamation when Rosa Parks died for all government flags to be flown at half staff around the world, at embassies around the world, and in Washington, D.C., and throughout the country. But there was another memorial, and this was an activist memorial. a memorial in Detroit where Rosa Parks lived and died, where Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, but perhaps more importantly, local activists, celebrated her life and pledged themselves to continue the struggle that she had committed her life to, countering and challenging and problematizing a very simplistic narrative about Rosa Parks, which we still read in many textbooks and see in many popular representations. That is, this kindly dignified seamstress who sort of accidentally, inadvertently stumbles into history. When in fact, of course, we know Rosa Parks was someone who had been very active in Montgomery, who had participated in a Highlander folk school strategy session not long before the boycott began, and was much more sophisticated and savvy than she was really ever given credit for, and then continued her activism after she left Montgomery, taking a stance against war and poverty and in support of labor issues and a whole variety of other progressive issues. At the Detroit Memorial also, Jackson and others spoke out against the conservative appointments to the Supreme Court and the threat represented to the legacy of the civil rights movement by those conservative appointments. Also at that memorial, people spoke out against the insatiable lust of a prison system for young black and brown bodies. So you see, there was a real contestation over how to bring closure to this individual's life in the context, on the terrain, of a struggle about how to define that period of the civil rights and black freedom struggle. By the time Coretta Scott King passed away a couple of years later, the script was polished, and her death was exploited further to give an artificial sense of closure, to further sanitize the movement, to further separate our memories from what the more progressive wing of that movement, the left wing of that movement, actually represented. And many of you recall her funeral in Atlanta was highly controversial. It was attended by four presidents, past and present, George Bush included, Harry Belafonte, who of course had been a strong supporter of not only the civil rights and black freedom movement, but the movement for justice around the world, was disinvited from the speaking roster at the funeral. Julian Bond declined to go inside because of the mockery that was being made of Coretta King's legacy. And the clincher was where the service was held, which really brings us to the point of who are the people who have accepted the mantle or who have assumed the mantle as spokespersons for the movement. Her funeral was held at the New Birth Missionary Baptist Church outside Atlanta, a corporate homophobic megachurch with a very flamboyant minister, Eddie Long. And the irony of that is Coretta King had not only spoken out around issues of racial justice, had spoken out very, very strongly on issues of gay rights in a speech in Chicago, and also had been the head of the Gay Pride March in Atlanta. And this is a church that has, you know, really celebrated a new growing conservatism within black religious community. So it was an irony that the service was held there, a further irony that someone like George Bush, who really has been no friend to the poor and no proponent of peace, would be making remarks to the exclusion of somebody like Harry Belafonte. Fortunately, Reverend Lowry from Southern Christian Leadership Conference was on the panel and made some very poignant brief remarks that really confronted the dual unfinished agenda of the movement, issues of fighting for peace and fighting against poverty, and pointed out the contradictions of the current administration's policies in that regard, with the president, of course, sitting right there. Some of you may remember the CNN coverage of this, and both Bushes were there, and they were quite displeased. But fortunately, there was a sort of moment of truth and light. Finally, in terms of thinking of those moments in the past 10 years or so in which we've seen a struggle or an inscribing of this new message onto a new generation of what the movement represent, I'm reminded of many of the cold cases, cold civil rights cases that have been reopened. Now, there's a way in which this is a good thing. This is really long overdue justice in many instances. It provides a certain closure to the families of people who were murdered in the cause of social justice in this period. But there's another way in which it allows us to very conveniently shift our gaze from the present to the past, again, writing a narrative of closure. The Emmett Till case was really reopened with the work of two very interesting filmmakers, Stanley Nelson, one of them who is actually at this conference, and the other is Keith Beauchamp, who was the filmmaker of the Untold Story of Emmett Till. Both of them pushed to uncover evidence that would implicate other people in Till's 1955 murder. But even and no indictments were issued in that case. But in a number of other cases, the Medgar Evers case, as well as a dozen or so civil rights cases from 30, 40 years ago, the FBI and the Justice Department have pursued reopening these cases. Gonzalez, before he was persuaded to step down, said that he was going to make a priority of reopening these cases. But we know now this was at the same time that the Justice Department was really expelling progressive attorneys from its ranks, attorneys who might have, in fact, made real and put teeth into many of the progressive victories that grew out of the movement. So one of the things that the Cole cases do is it allows for a certain language of closure. The Mississippi legislator, when the Brian De La Beckwith case finally was resolved, he said, it's a new day in Mississippi. We close that chapter. You know, a new day is dawning. Much of that language echoes around these cases once they're resolved. At the same time, we see growing disparities in poverty, new forms of racism, particularly in the prison system, as well as on the economic front. So these are moments or instances in which I think there is a real attempt to, and in many cases successful, to use the fact that there's a passing of a generation to retell, to reconstruct, to redefine what the movement represented and to create a new memory. Jacqueline Dowd Hall has been, I think, very helpful in giving us a language and a frame to talk about this long civil rights movement that challenges that kind of reinscription. So I want to actually also link this not only to the ritual of burial, but something that's very, very much alive, which is the present presidential race and the Democratic presidential race in particular. The civil rights movement, the black freedom movement, the words of Dr. King have been evoked dozens of times by the campaigns of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in particular. And if those of us who are historians who do work on this period needed any jolt to remind us of the powerful relevancy of the work that we do, I think this political moment has helped to do that. So back and forth in debates and in interviews and news conferences, the first woman to make a viable bid for the presidency and the first, of course, Shirley Chisholm, we remember in 72, but Shirley Chisholm didn't get the kind of support for many reasons that Hillary Clinton has. But the first woman to make a viable bid for the presidency and the first black man to do so have jockeyed for their positions relative to one another and relative to one of the most powerful social movements of the 20th century, a movement that reconfigured the racial landscape of the South and created a less unequal playing field for women in politics, public sector jobs, previously male-dominated professions, and sports. Between Obama and Clinton and their various surrogates, the legacy of the civil rights movement and the words of Dr. King have been heard repeatedly. Hillary, an admitted Goldwater girl, recalled the impact of hearing King speak at a 1963 Chicago appearance as a transformative moment. Barack Obama, at a Selma commemoration and relying heavily on biblical analogies, laid claim to the inheritance of the civil rights movement by deeming the 60s freedom fighters the Moses generation and his generation as the Joshua generation. Moses leading slaves out of slavery, Joshua leading folks into the promised land. In January, Hillary stood in the pulpit of Ebenezer Church, fully flanked by ministers, some of whom were movement veterans, and told her audience that she saw herself as the offspring, daughter, beneficiary of the movement's victories, and later offered her own telling analysis of what she viewed as the linchpin of victory for the civil rights movement, a president willing to put the law, willing to put into law the demands of a mass movement led by King. Of course, many of us challenge that scenario. Barack also was asked many times in the presidential debates, in the many presidential debates, the perennial question, what would King do? And his answer, I think, was telling and quite true. He said that King would not have endorsed either candidate, but he would go out and organize a movement and hold the candidates accountable. Now, I want to throw also something else briefly in the mix, which is something that wasn't talked about very much on the 68 panel, and I think gets eclipsed sometime, is how we factor the women's movement into this in the question of gender. Feminist icon Robin Morgan, in a February piece that she wrote called Goodbye to All That, and Gloria Steinem writing in the New York Times a few months later, The Front Runners Are Never Women, added their own somewhat skewed, very skewed actually, views to this nexus between the political past and the political present. And there has been kind of a spin-off discussion on blogs and conference, a little meeting held and all that to try to flesh out what they meant in these two pieces. But in essence, you know, they bought into, I think, a narrative of closure about the issue of racial justice, and then framed the question of gender as the unfinished agenda of the civil rights era. That is, in fact, that people have come so far on the question of race, but still have so far to go on the question of race of gender. But I think when we really look at the political landscape to go, we have a long way to go on both of these questions. So the way in which both of these campaigns have used their connection to the civil rights movement or framed their connection to the black freedom struggle allows us to, or encourages us to, ask a number of questions about the contested nature of our memory. What version of the 50s, 60s, and 70s do we hear in the echo chamber of political candidate speech? And where does that narrative take us on the long trajectory from 1968 to today? If this generation is the Joshua generation and the heirs of the 1960s, what mantle have they inherited, and what is the inheritance tax? Where did the movement leave things? What is the promised land that we seek entrance to, if we want to continue that biblical metaphor? There are a lot of problematic answers to these questions, and some, I dare say, are dangerous. Some believe Barack to be the actual corporeal embodiment of the interracial ideal that King talked about in his famous I Have a Dream speech. Many people want to read Barack Obama as a racial redemption candidate. After all, a nation who could elect a black man as president can't be racist, right? So as Milcar Cabral said, we should accept no easy victories. That would be far too easy a victory. Last night on the 1968 panel, again, people talked about the dangers of fixating on a single decade or a single year, and I think there's a similar danger on fixating on a single individual. And hopefully, as academics, we've moved beyond a King-centric narrative, but I think there is still a danger in the public sphere, and there's certainly a danger in politics, which is this notion that we will have this patriarchal savior that will redeem us in one way or another. In outlining her notion of the long civil rights movement, Jackie Hall has given us an important frame. She gives us a frame that challenges us to ask several questions about the dominant civil rights narrative. What is winning? What is the temporal frame we're wrapping around the movement? And who are the historical actors that we put center stage when we enact the dramas of the past through the interpretive lens of film, books, museum exhibits, and the rhetoric of political campaigns? And this is where the work of a whole remarkable generation of scholars, Some of them young, some of them more mature, but people who have done work in recent years have stretched the civil rights, black freedom movement in both directions, back toward the New Deal and forward into and beyond the 1970s. I won't read the names of all of those people, but I think particularly the work of Pramila Nadison, who has done work on the welfare rights movement and linked that movement for economic justice and for women's leadership and autonomy to this larger narrative of the civil rights movement. Rhonda Williams' work and Martha Biondi's work and Winston Grady Willis's work, as well as the work of Kamozi Woodard and others, take us further down this path. Their work challenges us to look at an unfinished agenda in a very different way. That is, we can't really talk about the legacy of King or the larger movement really that produced King without, in a more immediate sense today, talking about the legacy of Katrina, without talking about and challenging the growing criminalization of black and Latino youth, without challenging the growing wealth disparities and global union busting that has become routine, without challenging the threat to Roe v. Wade, without supporting the efforts of domestic workers to organize, without seriously engaging the very exciting dialogue going on from Southern Africa to Latin America through the World Social Forum and others. Clay Carson rightly said that certain injustices have been relegated to the dustbins of history and to the texts of history books. But sadly, many injustices that were on the minds and agendas of folks in the 1960s are still with us today. As historians, we study change over time, but we also study the continuities and carryovers. Some of those carryovers are the continued fight against poverty and the continued fight for peace in the world. And as we stand in the middle of yet another unjust, ill-conceived war where over 4,000 Americans have died and untold numbers of Iraqis, and witness a government spending $75,000 a minute, actually, on this war, it really behooves us to take seriously what we have inherited as an unfinished agenda. I would add to that list the challenge of confronting patriarchy, particularly in how we see and define leadership and history, and confronting the increasingly dangerous reality of a prison nation. There are three other concrete lessons for me, not only as an academic, but also as an activist 40 years after King's death. One is the important lesson of the latter part of King's life, which is the courage that it takes to take positions not on the easy issues of our time, but on the difficult ones and the controversial ones and the ones we'll catch flack for. And I'm reminded of that legacy being very much alive in the work of Jimmy Carter and Bishop Desmond Tutu, both of whom have taken a lot of criticism and flack for their very courageous statements in support of Palestinian human rights. I'm also reminded that no savior will save us. And while we may talk about Moses and Joshua, King understood, in fact, that it took a movement to accomplish the progress that was accomplished. Ella Baker understood it when she said Martin didn't make the movement, but the movement made Martin. A presidential election is not a movement, and a president is not a savior. So in closing, let me come back to the question of the urgency of now. There's been some discussion in this political campaign, too, about the issue of plagiarism. And kind of mocking the seriousness of what plagiarism can mean in some of our universities and so forth. But really, if we're talking about borrowing good ideas for people involved in the same struggle and in a just struggle, then spreading those ideas rather than branding them and commodifying them, I think, is a very good thing. And one term and expression that has been borrowed by many different candidates in this campaign is one that I found originated with Audre Lorde, who was a black feminist radical poet who died some years ago, and that was this notion that we are the ones we've been waiting for. John Edwards said it in a National Press Club speech about 3 years ago, and Barack Obama has repeated it and now has it on his website, and Hillary Clinton has it as well. And so I think in terms of thinking as historians and scholars and citizens and those of us who are activists, one of the important lessons about the links between the struggles of the 1960s and the political realities we confront today, which are enormous, is that we are indeed the ones that we've been waiting for. And while we pay homage to and respect the work of King and his colleagues, our work is challenging, and we best get to it. Thank you.